Coronation procession of unexampled brilliance moved off from the royal palace in Budapest. The great ones of the land, in numbers never seen before, dressed in their picturesque magnates' costumes, and riding on noble horses, with trappings gleaming with gold, assembled to do honour to the kingdom of Hungary, but at the same time to display their own pomp and power. The emperor, Franz Josef, wearing the uniform of a Hungarian marshal and riding on horseback, his empress, Elizabeth, looking bewitchingly lovely in Hungarian national costume with a diamond crown on her head, and driving in a state coach drawn by 8 horses, the lifeguards with leopard skins floating from their shoulders and riding on their grey horses, made up a picture of bewildering brilliance, which recalled the proudest splendours of the Kingdom of Hungary and the aristocracy in the palmiest days of the Middle Ages. In the year 1000, the Pope Sylvester gifted the zealous Christian King Stephen I of Hungary with the title Apostolic King, later rendered Majesty, by a papal bull, a segment of which follows. According to the testimony of Daniel, he changeth the times and the seasons, he removeth kings and setteth up kings, he revealeth the deep and secret things, he knoweth what is in the darkness, for in him is that light which, as John teaches, lighteth every man that cometh into the world. Therefore we first give thanks to God the Father and to our Lord Jesus Christ, because he has found in our time another David, and has again raised up a man after his own heart to feed his people Israel, that is, the chosen nation of the Hungarians. Through his conversion efforts, turning the Magyars away from paganism, Stephen held the missionary position of apostleship. Due to his loyalty to the Pope, his efforts were sanctioned by the apostolic successor of St. Peter. Yet more than a simple recognition of Stephen's achievements, the title conferred on him the office of Apostolic Legate of the Pope to exercise full power over the Church in Hungary. Hungary had attained a glorious rank in the hierarchy of medieval Christian principalities. Indeed, following the collapse of the Byzantine Empire, Hungary was recognized as the bulwark of Christendom against the Turks until the disaster at Mohács. The title of Apostolic King rivaled that of the most Christian King of France, and later the Spanish Most Catholic Majesty and English Defender of the Faith. The successors of Pope Sylvester were also aware and wary of the implications of the title. They were careful to ensure that the privileges granted to King Stephen reverted after Stephen, against Hungarian assumptions that the style was intrinsic to the office of king. The fate of the title was an analogy for the fortunes of Hungary itself. The Habsburgs attempted to claw back this distinction as the new kings of Hungary for over 200 years. When Leopold I won the Kingdom of Hungary back from the Turks, the title Apostolic Majesty was employed extensively to assert Leopold's own royal supremacy. However, it was only during the reign of Mary Theresa that the Pope, Clement XIII, granted a Hungarian ruler the same distinction as that of King Stephen. The notion that Maria Theresa was the apostolic queen became the rock on which she revived the Habsburg monarchy. From Hungary, she reconquered Bohemia, who had elected a rival, Charles of Bavaria, as king in opposition to her. From there, she would make her husband France's Holy Roman Emperor, a title which paled in its practical significance compared to that of the Apostolic Queen. During the partitions of Poland, Maria Theresa justified the monarchy's expansion on the basis that these Polish lands had once belonged to a king of Hungary. So long as she was alive, even though her son Joseph II was Holy Roman Emperor, Hungary retained a distinction and autonomy like no other province of the composite monarchy. Joseph II, when Maria Theresa finally died, failed to defeat the Hungarian magnates. When Francis I made himself Emperor of Austria, Hungary still possessed legal rights, rights upon which Lajos Kossuth would justify the Hungarian Revolution of 1848-49. The title of Apostolic Majesty that had been granted to the Magyarphile Mary Theresa, with which she reconquered her empire, in turn conquered Franz Josef. 1867 was the beginning of his reign in Hungary. The 20 years that had preceded it were now retroactively considered an illegal occupation. As part of the Ausgleich, or Hungarian Compromise, Franz Josef had conceded 10 of the 12 points demanded of the revolutionaries in 1848. Hungary was personally considered in union with Austria and not subordinate to her. There were separate parliaments and prime ministers, with the exception of finance, defence and foreign policy, with common ministries for the refashioned state of Austria-Hungary. The financial contributions to the common treasury and tariffs were negotiated via decennial agreements. Within Hungary, this marked a period of ascendancy, dominated at first by the compromise faction of Deand Andrássy of the Hungarian Liberal Party. They dominated the parliament through gerrymandering and maintained a restricted franchise of 10% of the population, those able to vote. Though many Hungarians were unsatisfied by the compromise, we can view in hindsight the wisdom of compromise politicians who saw that Hungary's prestige and influence were elevated by the Habsburg link. Austria-Hungary, as a European necessity, was essential to prevent Russian expansion. The Russian army, after all, had crushed the Hungarian Revolution of 1848-49. What powers Franz Josef retained at the expense of Hungary, the Liberal Party were able to compensate in other areas, such as through an aggressive policy of enforced national homogeneity, known as Magyarization. Franz Josef had been defeated by the forces of nationalism in Italy, Germany, and now in Hungary. The Rump of Austria, also known as Cisleitania, after the River Leitha, the historical demarcation point between Austria and the Old Kingdom of Hungary, was a volcano of potential nationality conflicts. To quote the words from Sylvester's Bull, "The chosen nation of Hungarians had been raised, though their king was diminished, if not removed." If Hungary can achieve such an exceptional status, why not the Czechs, the Poles, the Slovenes, the Italians, etc., etc.? The following segment is taken from Wycroft's The Habsburgs. After 1867, the mechanism by which to identify the army had become more complex, with the Kaiserreich imperial element of Austria and the Königlich royal entity of Hungary. Written together as KK, they provided the abbreviation for the full name of this new state of Austria-Hungary, as USA stands for the United States of America. However, a subsequent imprint had been overlaid on this image of the empire. In his novel, The Man Without Qualities, Robert Musil defined it as Kakania, another fanciful Central European state like Anthony Hopper's Ruritania. Here, one was in the centre of Europe, at the focal point of the world's old axis. There was some display of luxury, but it was not, of course, as over-sophisticated as that of the French. One went in for sport, but not in a madly Anglo-Saxon fashion. One spent tremendous sums on the army, but only just enough to ensure one of remaining the second weakest among the great powers. The capital, too, was somewhat smaller than all of the rest of the world's largest cities, but nevertheless quite considerably larger than a mere ordinary large city. The administration of this country was carried out in an enlightened, hardly perceptible manner, with a cautious clipping of all sharp points by the best bureaucracy in Europe, which could be accused of only one defect. It could not help regarding genius and enterprise, unless privileged by high birth or state appointment, as ostentation, indeed presumption. But who would want unqualified people putting their oar in anyway? And besides, in Cacania, it was only that a genius was always regarded as a lout, but never, as sometimes happened elsewhere, that a mere lout was regarded as a genius. All of which was true, and the final joke was in the name of this state itself, for as spoken, it evoked the German nursery word kaka, which means feces. So Cacania might possibly be rendered in English as shitteria. The state over which Franz Josef ruled was so much mocked and burlesqued, was indeed in constitutional terms like no other. But its ambience, as Musil suggests, was also unique. One could refer to it as Habsburgica. For the old emperor, this notion of a single multinational empire based on the same fundamental principles as informed a single army was the truest expression of the Habsburgs' dynastic ideal. His only means of expressing it personally was through his scrupulous attention to duty and by being emperor to all his peoples. Indeed, as we have the rendering, Austria-Hungary, of Kaiserlich and Königlich, K.K., imperial and royal, and then the derisive name, the parody of Cacania, which very much evokes a earlier association with another stream I did on Ludwig II, referring to the pumpernickel states of Germany, i.e. those nations who only exist as a result of dynastic contrivance, or in the case of Austria, one can refer to this as Hausmarkt. But in terms of looking at this as a state, a multinational empire, based around nothing more than this bizarre constitutional unequal settlement, however, with all these links to dynasty, to the emperor, another way of looking at this is a Kaisertum, or the emperor's throne. The need to create loyalty to the dynasty was paramount, especially when other forces, nationalist and class-based, were pulling in opposite directions. The resources that the Habsburg could deploy were the personality of the emperor and the Empress Elizabeth, and a sense of a majestic past. The milestones of Franz Josef's life were the natural focus for staged expressions of public loyalty, beginning with the imperial couple's silver wedding in April of 1879, the wedding of Rudolf and Stephanie of Belgium in 1881, when the celebration of 1,000 years of Hungarian monarchy in 1896, then 1898, the silver jubilee of the emperor's accession in Hungary, and in 1908, a pageant honouring 60 glorious years. The desire to promote both the past identity and future direction of the monarchy took a number of forms. The first and most permanent were buildings. The Votikirche, erected in commemoration of Franz Josef's lucky escape from an assassin's knife in 1853, set the pattern, and in subsequent years, the towns of the empire showed their patriotism by taking collections and erecting buildings, from hospitals to schools and orphanages, generally named after the emperor or the empress. In many cases, either the emperor himself or one of the imperial family would perform the opening ceremony. This, in its way, did do something to bring the monarchy closer to the people. The emperor became not merely a portrait on the wall, but a living being whom many had seen with their own eyes. The celebration of the silver wedding of Franz Josef and Elizabeth in April of 1879 was planned as a great festival of the Habsburg past. The public commemoration of the event in the capital was an enormous pageant designed by the artist Hans Markert, in which some 10,000 people took part, all dressed in the lavish costumes of Habsburg Flanders in the era of the Emperor Charles V in the 16th century. When the imperial couple went to Budapest to receive congratulations from the Hungarians, there was an almost wild enthusiasm. But this was nothing compared to the surge of excitement in 1896, when the emperor, dressed in the uniform of a general of hussars, drove with the Empress Elizabeth in Mary Theresa's glass coach to the new and still unfinished Parliament building above the Danube. There they received the Holy Crown of St. Stephen, the emblem of Hungarian nationhood, and later in the evening, on a great open field to the west of Castle Hill, oxen were roasted and given to the people. All that night, the city blazed with the newly installed electrical illuminations. In spite of all the political implications, Franz Josef's Hungarian coronation was a boon to his marriage, the Empress Elizabeth. Prior to the compromise, the Ausgleich, Elizabeth, rather arbitrarily it would seem, if we consider her ambivalence towards the other peoples of the empire, became a champion of Hungarian exceptionalism. With the compromise, the style of apostolic majesty was conferred on both the emperor and the empress, but the latter held it in higher esteem, perhaps in the spirit of the memory of the great apostolic queen Maria Theresa. The couple had four children, three of which survived infancy, including the crown prince Rudolf. By the 1870s, Elizabeth had come to tolerate the emperor's romantic affairs. Indeed, Franz Josef would become enamoured of the Viennese actress Katharina Schratt. With Schratt separated from her husband, Elizabeth actively encouraged a platonic relationship between the actress and Franz Josef. This companionship lasted, with one exception, for 30 years, until the emperor's death in 1916. Nevertheless, if there is one phrase that could accurately encapsulate the private life or the tragedy of the later Franz Josef, it would be his own phrase, uttered upon hearing the assassination of Elizabeth: "I am spared nothing in this world." His brother Maximilian, Emperor of Mexico, was executed at the same time of the Hungarian coronation. Despite the personal and political animosity between the two brothers, Franz Josef ensured that the body was returned to Trieste and buried in the imperial crypt with the honours reserved for a Habsburg archduke. This despite Franz Josef having forced his brother to relinquish that distinction when Maximilian embarked on his Mexican venture. Franz Josef's grandfather, Francis I, had resorted to the infamous Habsburg practice of cousin marriage. The result of this union was the incapable Emperor Ferdinand and the unassuming Franz Karl, who Franz Josef had skipped in the succession. Franz Josef had first expected to marry his cousin Helene, before falling in love with Elizabeth, Helene's younger sister, and obviously still a cousin. Their son Rudolf possessed traces of brilliance. He had directly patronized an encyclopedic compendium of all the provinces of the empire as part of the wider Habsburg effort in cultivating loyalty through an appeal to history in the vein of the Archduke Johann and Hormeyer during the Napoleonic Wars. Despite this, he was notorious for his alcoholism and sexual promiscuity. He likely suffered from gonorrhea and syphilis, made the Princess Stephanie, his wife, infertile, ensuring they would not have any children, and he became addicted to morphine. In 1888, he began an affair with one Baroness Vetsera, and a few months later, they were found dead at the hunting lodge in Meierling. Rumours abounded that the Crown Prince had been assassinated by poison, until it became clear that the two were involved in a murder-suicide pact. A formula was found where Rudolf was declared mentally unstable in order to receive a church funeral. Franz Josef rededicated Meierling as a Carmelite nunnery, where prayers were offered for the Crown Prince's soul. Empress Elizabeth, despite her attachment to Hungary, was notorious for her uneasiness with the demands of court ritual. She spent her reign travelling through Europe. Corfu, in particular, was her favourite destination. In 1898, Elizabeth travelled to Geneva incognito. A man called Luigi Licheni had arrived in Geneva with the desire to commit an act of propaganda of deed, in other words, to murder the highest profile figure he could find. His first target was the Orleanist pretender to the French throne, but he instead assassinated the Empress once her presence was made known. With his son and elder brothers dead, Franz Josef's nephew, Franz Ferdinand, was the heir presumptive to the empire. Given the emperor's age, Franz Ferdinand and his Belvedere circle became a prominent power block in the empire. In 1900, Franz Ferdinand married the Countess Sophie Chotek. the marriage of the heir of the empire to a woman not of the blood royal caused such consternation in the emperor that he, Franz Ferdinand, was forced to renounce any rights of his children to inherit the throne. By the time of the Diamond Jubilee, the closest relative to the emperor still alive was his brother, Ludwig Victor, the libertine, institutionalized homosexual whom Franz Josef had banished from Vienna. This segment is taken from Radies the Habsburgs. Plans for a jubilee to celebrate Franz Josef's 50th anniversary as emperor had to be pared back in 1898 on account of the empress's assassination. The 60th anniversary celebrations were thus planned on a scale that was unprecedented. Two processions would pass through the centre of Vienna to do homage to Franz Josef. The first would provide a tableau of the history of the dynasty, and the second would display the allegiance of the empire's peoples to their ruler in a parade that brought to life the multi-volume Crown Prince's work. Dynasty, nation, and empire would fuse in a collective affirmation of loyalty to the aging emperor. Difficulties arose from the start. The Hungarian government refused to be involved on the grounds that as King of Hungary, Franz Josef had begun his reign in 1867 and not in 1848. The Vienna City Council had recently banned a performance of Hamlet because it was to be delivered in Czech, so the Czechs were already disaffected. Then the choice of historical tableau caused rancour. The organisers of the pageant had decided to commence the procession with King Rudolf of Habsburg, king as in King of the Romans in the 13th century, the first Habsburg ruler to rule over Austria itself, but his defeat of King Ottokar of Bohemia, i.e. Czechia, made him unacceptable to the Czechs, who now absented themselves entirely. A tableau commemorating Radetzky's defeat, the famous Radetzky March, of a rebellion in Lombardy, led in turn to an Italian boycott. Italians still formed a large number of the empire's population in Dalmatia, in Carniola, and in the Tyrol region, of which was still part of the Austrian Empire. The Croats almost walked out too, the Croatians, upon learning that their role in the tableau recalling 1848, the revolutions, was to play the part of looters, and the programme had to be adjusted at the last minute. The processions of the peoples made up in numbers for the missing Hungarians, Czechs, and Italians, with some 8,000 participants parading past the emperor, who stood for 3 hours beneath a massive mock-up of Rudolf II's crown that had been set up on the ring. Rudolf II's crown, during the early 17th century, is the crown most associated with the Austrian Empire, though there was never a formal coronation ceremony within Austria itself. Indeed, it should be noted that the Czechs and Hungarians absenting themselves mean that the two largest demographics outside of the Germans themselves weren't present at the Jubilee ceremony. National costumes had been divided for the occasion, which often had little to do with what people really wore, although the homage of the city of Vienna was led by gentlemen in white tie and top hats. After them came, according to an eyewitness report, Styrians in loden coats and hats with green bands, southern Tyrolean marksmen with grey jackets, Ruthenes, and here and there a Polish Jew in a kaftan with a velvet cap on his head. One feature of the procession was the disproportionately large number of participants coming from the poorer parts of the empire. Paid a pittance to attend, they flocked in their thousands from Bukovina, a territory between Polish Galicia, Lodomeria, Ruthenian Galicia, Lodomeria, and Romania. Dalmatia and Galicia, often clad in only the crudest of garments. Rustic simplicity as urban spectacle was the verdict of one leading socialist newspaper. The Jubilee celebration was at the time deemed a success, with 300,000 spectators lining the Ringstrasse in Vienna. No serious accidents, and the emperor was visibly moved. But as the liberal newspaper, the Neue Freie Presse, observed, a parade was all it had been, and the cacophony of languages spoken by the participants only emphasized a sense of mutual incomprehension. On top of language, the contrasting levels of development between nations were all too obvious. Some spectators reported shock at confronting the uncouth representatives of the poorer parts of the empire who frightened children, so one journalist remarked, with their weather-beaten and haggish faces. The architect, Adolf Loos, felt he was witnessing barbarian tribes from the medieval ages. Despite the praise it received at the time, the Jubilee was, in some respects, a double flop. Not only did the recitation of Habsburg history prompt a boycott by the Czechs, Hungarians, and Italians, but the procession of peoples also highlighted differences, division, and a sense of cultural hierarchy. Indeed, once the procession was over, fights and bullying erupted between the various national groups camped out in Prater Park. Nevertheless, as they had progressed before the imperial days set up outside the Hofburg, the participants saluted the emperor. Ultimately, it was Franz Josef's person alone that excited loyalty. The emperor had grown old with his reign. By 1870, his hair was receding and his moustache greying. Over the next decade, his whiskers whitened and he went completely bald. Except for the spreading lines around his eyes, he looked almost identical for the next 35 years, thus conveying a sense of his own timelessness and that of the perpetuation of the dynasty. On every public occasion, he said the same thing. It was nice. We enjoyed it. His dress seldom changed either, being invariably a military tunic with red cavalry trousers. But it was as the Emperor of Peace that he was most frequently portrayed, on the grounds that he had, after 1866, the debacle of Königgrätz, where the Prussians defeated the Austrians and kicked them out of the German Confederation, had kept the empire out of war. Peace went hand in hand with his own personal Catholic piety and with his studious performance of the time-honored Catholic rituals. A letter circulated by the Catholic hierarchy in Cisleitania drew attention to his example of faithfulness to the truth, of the conscientious observance of religious duties, and of a selfless forbearance. The tragedies that dogged Franz Josef and the violent deaths of his brother, son, and wife yielded a further image of the emperor as the man of sorrows. He was, as one popular biography put it, one of the most sorely tried bearers of human pain. Despite his tribulations, he remained a mighty rock in the middle of surging waves. Even devoted to the needs of his peoples and working deep into the night, not resting so that his subjects might sleep safely. Franz Josef's personal sorrows and the burdens of rule were even compared to Christ's crown of thorns, confirming the emperor as not only the ruler of peoples, but also their redeemer. The emperor would rise and work from 5 o'clock in the morning, and during the First World War, he would rise as early as 4 o'clock in the morning. Franz Josef's virtues and portrait were communicated in a string of publications aimed at popular consumption and bearing such titles as Our Emperor, Hooray Habsburg, and Austria's Day of Joy. These were not restricted to German editions, but went into most of the languages of the empire. There were also plaster busts, as well as ashtrays and aprons bearing Franz Josef's likeness. The authorities attempted to keep track of the circulation of portraits, forbidding the emperor's face to appear on rubber balls. Most spectacularly, in 1908, hundreds of thousands of Galician poles and ruthenes brought from an enterprising merchant cheap transparencies of the emperor, putting them in their windows so at night the streets of towns and villages shone with identical portraits of Franz Josef. The emperor thus became the almost exclusive focus of loyalty, a symbol of an idea that transcended nation, but much was invested in a mortal who had already exceeded his biblically appointed lifespan, that being the 80, 70 years. As the Neue Freie Presse warned in 1908, if we look beyond him, that is, when our thoughts become troubled and anxious, long may the fate of the monarchy lie, therefore, in his experienced hands, so that he can lead the country to unity, peace, and reconciliation. 8 years later, the emperor will be dead, with these goals still unaccomplished. In this respect, Franz Josef's final words, "Why does it have to be now?" captured the meaning of his unfulfilled reign more precisely than his personal motto, "With powers united." The army, now the imperial and royal army, had only one vision of Austria, which was as a vast army. In the regiments, discipline, passive obedience, the commander's word as law, obliterated all diversity of origins and all nationalistic sentiments. Under the regimental banners, all Austrians were only Austrians, the cult of the dynasty, of the emperor as the supreme commander, the supreme warlord, brought all together by applying the same method to the population at large, to give, would it not be possible to create a sense of a single Austria, just in the same way that a single army had been created? This, of course, ignoring the fact that Austrian officers had to be bilingual, which was especially complicated if you had many different nationalities per regiment. But nevertheless, this was said by one Louis Eisenman at the Paris Exposition of 1900, where Austria was competing. Against this, the dream of the neo-absolutist Franz Josef was the nationality conflict volcano. I once referred to this period of political experimentation as the incorporation of farce into the constitution of Austria-Hungary. An Austrian minister-president put it as a condition of even and well-modulated discontent in Cisplatonia. Germans never achieved the place that the liberal Hungarian clique had achieved in Transylvania. Von Beust, a Saxon and later minister-president of the whole empire, or last minister-president of the whole empire, perceived the Ausgleich as nothing more than a temporary concession which would be annulled when Austria won the inevitable rematch against Prussia following the disaster of 1866. The rematch never occurred. Indeed, Austria would enter into an alliance with Germany that would continue until Austria-Hungary's end, dissolution. The Great Depression of 1873 damaged the Germans, and more precisely, the German liberals' fervour. And by 1879, Minister-President von Taffer, the most consequential, perhaps, of all the Cisleitanian politicians, pursued a policy of equality of the nationalities, especially of reconciling the Czechs. Indeed, the pro-Czech policy of the government culminated in the Badeni Patent, which mandated that bureaucrats in Bohemia be proficient in both German and Czech, a move which effectively invalidated the German-speaking population, and thus the policy was quickly abandoned. To outflank the liberals, conservative ministers, including von Taffer, advocated for expanding the vote to the working classes, who then went on to support the socialists. Nevertheless, what threat the socialists could possibly pose to the emperor was undermined by the fact that they, in spite of their internationalist pretensions of the union of all the workers across the world, were divided themselves into nationality groups. The German response to the dynasty was becoming ever more diffuse. The Christian socials supported the system, yet their populism around the Vienna mayor Karl Lueger caused Franz Josef to disown the movement. Schönerer led a group of German nationalists who advocated for seceding from the empire and joining with Germany, even abandoning Catholicism and converting to Protestantism. As more were given the right to vote, the more incongruous the Reichsrat, the parliament, became. Indeed, the more indispensable the imperial bureaucracy with the emperor at the top as first servant of the state appeared. The political constant of the 19th century was Hausmacht, the power of the dynasty, as it had originally been conceived of in 1804 when Francis created the Austrian Empire. Despite the division of the empire into two halves, Franz Josef successfully annexed the Ottoman provinces of Bosnia and Herzegovina, placing them as a co-dominion of Austria and Hungary under the common finance ministry. Yet this posed a problem. If there were any future prospects of expanding the empire, the delicate balance of power between the nationalities would be affected. Two solutions towards reforming the empire were proposed under the sponsorship of Franz Ferdinand's Belvedere Circle. The first was the United States of Greater Austria, which would divide Hungary up into Slovak and Romanian areas. The second was a solution known as trialism, which would recognize the Slavs in the empire. Both solutions represented an existential threat to the pride of place given to the Hungarians. Franz Josef had begun his reign with the Radetzky March, the defeat of the revolutions in Italy, and of the Kingdom of Piedmont-Sardinia that had supported the revolutions. As relations with Russia collapsed following the annexation of Bosnia-Herzegovina, Austria's chief of staff von Hötzendorf advocated for a preemptive war to stave off the possibility of another Piedmont emerging to incite rebellion within the empire by appealing to the aspirations of one of its nationality groups. This Piedmont was thought to be Serbia, though ultimately all the neighbouring states save Germany, but including Austria's quote-unquote allies, Italy and Romania, had territorial designs on the empire, as would be proven by how the empire was carved up following the First World War. When Franz Ferdinand was assassinated by a Bosnian Serb terrorist group in Sarajevo, Hötzendorf found his pretext for a preventative war with this wannabe Piedmont in Serbia. Franz Josef was convinced by his foreign minister von Berchtold, with pressure from the German Kaiser, that such a war was just, something that the emperor would never come to doubt as the Serb War evolved rapidly into a world war. Yet instead of a glorious reenactment of the Radetzky March in the Balkans, this was a Hötzendorf flop. The first Serb campaign was a failure. Austria gradually lost her freedom of initiative, becoming dependent on the might of Germany. Franz Josef died on the 21st of November, 1916, at the age of 86, having ruled Austria for 68 years. Within 2 years, Austria-Hungary would cease to exist.